Alan Crane Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2022. Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. And this is continuing the theme of risk and return, which we have talked about at some briefly last week. But this is where we get into the details and we get to the sort of the pinnacle formula of finance, the capital asset pricing model. The formula itself is actually pretty easy math, but it carries a great deal of importance in terms of what the implications are to our understand how we make investments and what an investment portfolio, how we create our expectations based upon science and math and all of that. Like I said, though, the math isn't that complicated at all. First, a look at the numbers here. You see how grim the day was. It was a bear day. It wasn't a horrible bear day, but it was down. And it had a real strong surge down in the morning and just to about noon. And then it began to slowly somewhat recover. It certainly didn't recover all the way. But at the same time, there was a sell-off. Investors were getting rid of their selling stocks. Now, where was the money going? The next thing, of course, just quickly, though, before we answer that, crude oil went up. But it still is staying in that trading range that I told you about, $82 to $89 a barrel. It seems to be comfortable there. It'll bounce up and down in that range, but it doesn't seem to have much urgency to find a lower or higher place to be. So nothing spectacular there. Gold and silver, though, down good and hard. So commodities weren't doing so well. The metals weren't. Investors getting rid of stocks, getting rid of metals. Well, what about bonds? Well, the bond yields were up, so the prices were down. So investors are selling bonds. They're getting out of stocks. They're getting out of bonds. They're getting out of metals. So this would tell us that they're moving it to cash, in other words, to money market mutual funds. In other words, getting it to a parking place where there's no risk in it at that point. And that's about all they can do right now because it's like we don't have a direction. It's like wait and see. Get your money out, put it into the cash, and just wait to see if there's some numbers that are going to tell us more about what's coming ahead. Excuse me. London really didn't do anything. It bounced up and down. Finally finished down a little bit, 0.17. Excuse me. 0.17%. So nothing there to really talk about. Japan actually had a fairly strong early in the Japanese, in the Tokyo day. But then after that, it just sort of quietly faded off. Nothing spectacular. It just lost a little ground. But not really anything to talk about there. The thing about this is that we have the markets are not in a good mood right now, but they're also not in a terrible mood either. So we just have to wait and see what's coming next. Now, coming out of that for a little bit here, let me show you something. I'm going to just pull up a stock here. And I'll do Microsoft here. Microsoft is a quiet company, and it's just a good example of a company that has a beta that is around 1, and a PE ratio that's just a little below 30. So we could say that this is a market-based, it's about as risky as the market as an investment. But that would not be true. because beta is measuring only the part of the risk that you cannot remove. There's a lot of risk in any given security that is there, but you don't have to keep it. And so you should not expect a reward for it. Examples for what would I want to do? What have I been looking at? New ADB SQ. I don't know. Just having a look at something a little more dicey. Well, I showed you MRO. Marathon Oil is a very risky stock, even in a well-diversified portfolio. And on its own, this thing would be a nightmare because it would be, the volatility would just be tragic to try to keep track of it. That's where we get to this, what we want to talk about as part, first part of the discussion of risk is, I'm trying to think. What do we mean by diversifying risk? By getting rid of it. This is a principle that is not finance. This is all through nature, from here to the farthest galaxies, to from biology to chemistry. The same principle that I'm going to show you is applied. But I'll start with it with a simple example of healthcare cost. Over the life of a person. And do it like this. I'm going to start with you, sir. I'm going to tell you about your life, your healthcare costs. Okay? You started off, you were a rather sickly young baby. And it got worse, but we finally got you better. And in your early toddler years, you weren't too bad. Then you find out about tricycles, had a couple of broken bones and all that. Then we got you past that. And then you got into some of your childhood illnesses. But then it was quiet. And then you got into your teen years. You had some spikes. You had rehab. And then you had a couple of good years. And then you got into your 20s. And you got, in your 20s, you begin to feel better. You know, those early childhood sicknesses like barfing and the diarrhea and the lung infections and the ear infections start to kind of fade away, and you're in your healthier time with your herd immunities building. Then we got you into your 30s. There was your high blood pressure, your cholesterol, and then you had to have your Viagra, and then kind of tailed off, and then you had your first heart attack, diabetes. Then you got kind of quiet in your later years, and then more and more medicines, and then you die. Now I'm going to tell you about you, madam. You started off healthy. Mm-hmm. You were a very good, you know, nothing wrong with you at all. But you did have a couple of scraped knees and broken bones. And then somewhere here, around 13, you found out about boys and acne. And then you had some other physical problems. But everything got quiet and calm. You had cancer, but you fought it and you won. And then you live. You're getting sicker as you get older, but you're in fairly good health. And you live to about 90, and then you die. Here's the point of this. If I put a whole bunch of these together, and I add up each time point for a whole bunch of people and process that, it'll be a virtually straight line. It's predictable. In other words, we're talking about what's called the phenomenon of risk pooling. The more people you put in, the more they cancel out each other's peculiarities until you get to a level where all that is left is the risk of the system itself, not of the individuals in it. This was an important thing to understand about insurance. And it's even more important today, because long-time insurance was very cherry-picking. Well, we don't want this kind of person in our pool, or we don't want that. That was just defeating the purpose of it. Because when some people are sick, others are well. When some people are well, others are sick. The more people you put in, the more you are going to smooth out that overall noise and get down to the hum of the underlying risk. This is what happens when you put more and more stocks into a portfolio. Their individual wildness calms down, and there's less and less of that, and more of the underlying risk. I'm trying to think. You, madam, you're a serial killer. I mean, you did terrible things to that corn checks. But, okay, you go out and you kill people. But at a party, you're a very normal person. You see, under the influence of the group, the individual behaviors are suppressed. That's an important point. In employment as well, one of the things we're finally getting through the thick skulls of corporations is, lay off your discrimination. All you're doing is making things worse for yourself. The more diversity you put in there, the more you get cancellation effect. So the overall group behavior becomes much more normal, much smoother. Oh, that's a strange program. We don't want that kind of program. You're just destroying the whole point of what the universe works like. Many years ago, I had a terrible thing happen one night. My daughter came to my office room, and she said, I want to join the orchestra at school, which was awful. And I asked what she wanted to play. She said, a viola. Have you ever heard of a person who can't play a viola? Play a viola. Mother of God. I finally moved to the garage. The cats did too. And then she said something one night that was just even worse. She said, we're having our Christmas concert, Daddy. Uh-oh. And I was quickly trying to find my calendar to find why I couldn't be there, even though I didn't know the date of it. But unfortunately, I couldn't. So I went to the Christmas concert, and sat there, and I thought, I'm in hell. And here came the little, about 85 fifth graders in with their little violins and violas and cellos. And I thought, this is going to be really bad. And they sat down and they were tuning up, and and then came in the director, the orchestra director, wonderful lady. She just retired recently from Normal Community High School. And tap, tap, tap. And I thought, here it comes. What came out was incredibly beautiful. Why? Because they were canceling out each other's errors. And the underlying was coming through. The Four Seasons by Vivaldi sounded as good with that group as it did with an orchestra, because they canceled each other's bad clinkers and all of that. This is what happens with choirs. You hear a choir singing, I mean, I know damn well that most of those church ladies and men who are singing there are horrible. And, but at the same time, when they get together and they sing, well, the angels come and they say, okay, we won't smite you dead with lightning. That's the whole thing, is that this happens all through the universe. Art is a place where it happens. I took a group of kids down to the art museum in St. Louis. And there was a great impressionist exhibit going on. There was this one girl, she was right up there looking at this work of impressionist art. I said, it's pretty messy, isn't it? She said, yeah. I said, let's go back here. I walked her back. I said, don't turn around until we get back about 15 feet. I said, now turn around. What do you see? It looks real. Uh-huh. The noise at the small level becomes the composite of something that is beautiful at the large level. That's why it was many years ago, the first of the new era of Batman movies. They originally hired architects to draw the Gotham City backdrop. and it looked horrible. It didn't look like real. And then finally someone said, you need impressionist artists to do it. Because then when people look at it at a distance as a background to the action scenes, it'll look every bit as real as anything you could imagine. There's the point we're making, is that noise, as you pull away from it, as you make it more of a composite, whatever it is, art, galaxies, planetary systems, music, it sounds, the pooling effect is real. And in finance, the more stocks you put into a portfolio, the more that pooling effect takes out the abnormal risks of the individual companies. A company like Tesla is run by a pothead, narcissistic personality, cluster B sociopath. I don't care. How does the stock do in a portfolio? And the same would be true of all of these other companies that have weird internal dynamics of the corporations. Their CEOs, CFOs, and all that are not the greatest human beings on earth. Sometimes you get all kinds of scandals. That really doesn't matter over a long period of time. If you have that stock in a well-diversified portfolio, individual company behaviors begin to vanish into the smoothness of the overall portfolio's performance. In this regard, and I'll talk more about portfolios in this class and how you make a good one and in subsequent classes, but one thing is for sure, if you're putting stocks into a portfolio, you don't want stocks that are highly correlated. You may remember from your statistics, the Pearson correlation coefficient. We keep an eye on that to decide what we want to put into a portfolio. You don't want stocks that move together too much. So you want the correlation coefficients between stocks, their returns, to be pretty low. I'll even show you a website where you can just list a bunch of ticker symbols and it'll show you the correlation coefficients among the stocks. I'll do that on Monday. But that's why it's not a good idea to say, well, I want to invest in healthcare stocks. Well, that's not a good idea, because you buy all the same stocks, healthcare stocks, they're going to all move the same way under the pressures of global economics. You have to find stocks that aren't related by industry. And sometimes you look at this correlation chart and you'll say, why are those correlated? Sometimes it's a mystery, but it does help not to be stuck on one industry. So, yeah, I'll put a stock or two from retail. I'll put a stock or two from industrial, from high tech, from green energy. In other words, find stocks that are not being buffeted by the abnormalities of their individual circumstances the same way. That's how you get that portfolio diversification to have its highest impact on your portfolio. Now, what are we talking about in terms of removing risk from a portfolio? If I were to draw, say, the number on the horizontal axis, the number of stocks, and on the vertical axis, the risk level of the portfolio, the first risk measure we use is always standard deviation. That's not the one we will finish with here, but it's a standard deviation. So, with one stock, you get a lot of risk. Put a couple of low correlation stocks together, less and less and less. And interestingly enough, you may remember this from your dark days in math, it asymptotically approaches a lower boundary. That is called the systematic risk, the systems risk. How many stocks does it take to do this? Well, you're not going to get it perfect, but you put 30 low correlation stocks together in portfolio, you've gotten rid of about 95% of the non-systematic, diversifiable risk if you put about 30 together. Now, that's a pain in the butt to do, and I will show you ways that you don't have to buy 30 stocks. They're called ETFs and mutual funds, and they'll do the portfolio diversification for you. Well, I'll talk about that in a little bit here. But I did want to spend, before I go any further, I want to talk a little more about risk. We use the term risk in an informal way. Well, that's a risky thing that you're doing there. But risk has different dimensions, interestingly enough. I'm going to ask you, madam, to help me out here. I want you to take this bottle of water. No, stand here, please, so everyone can see you. And I want to get close and fire. Ah! You see that pattern right there? That's how much I got. Remember, risk is variation in outcomes. Now, madam, step back. And again, fire. Ah! I said fire, not honk. Do you see how more pattern, larger area? This is like the time dimension. As more time is allowed, greater risk is being born in your behaviors. And in the world of stocks, that's the whole risk maturity premium. The farther the timeline goes, the more likely now fire all over me. Okay, now one more thing. I have another dimension of risk I'm going to ask you to help me with here. What are these?
Little chickens.
Not just any little chickens. These are killer chickens. Oh, yeah. I want you to attack me with these chickens. Pour them, no, take the whole bag and pour it over my head. Bark, 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 bark. Frequency of the incident was high. Look at all those chickens. But the severity was low. Now, what happens if you set loose in me a hidden, violent dragon? In fact, it is a fire-breathing dragon. How often do you see a dragon?
Never.
Very rarely. Let's put it that way. But the severity, I mean, that dragon can fricassee a whole town. Oh, you pissed me off. Okay? Thank you. Frequency low, severity high. So it's not just a matter of risk. It has to do with such things as how much time is going along. It also has to do with chickens. No, it has to do with the frequency versus the severity. Sometimes there are risks in a stock. This whips ups and downs. That's always going to be there. The real question is, how often do you get those violent black swans and white swans? That is a different kind of risk entirely. And so we have to appreciate that risk isn't a single dimension thing. We have to imagine all these different types of risk that are out there. And there's even another kind of risk too, the risk of ignorance. In fact, one of the worst problems we have in the world is people taking risks without all the information that they could have if they had taken more time. Investments are very much that way. A lot of the risk that people take is because they don't know what they're doing. If they researched it, if they studied it, they would find that they would make much more prudent decisions. This is why young people tend to have more accidents than older people. That's why their insurance rates are higher. It's because they do not have experience with all the possible things that can go wrong when you're driving a car. And so risk has that dimension as well. And it's worth it for me to bring this up because aside from the fact that my chickens just love this work that they do for me, the other part of it is that this is part of what we consider when we're talking about risk. Let me show you something here. A little secret in academia is that most universities give their, you if you're a teacher, if you're a good teacher, or if that's what you like to do, that's not really where you're going to get your big salaries or your high recognition and all of that. It's through the research that you do. You do research, you publish, and then no one reads your article ever again after it's published. But there are some kinds of research that have great deal of use, and sometimes they have use and we don't know it until later. I'll show you something that became a popular research topic years ago. Years ago. Imagine if you are a finance PhD student writing your dissertation, or a master's student, or maybe you're already hired and you're trying to get enough publications so that they'll keep you. And so you think, okay, what if I were to create different sizes of portfolios of stock? I'll measure the overall risk of the portfolio and see what the return was to this portfolio. So we start with a couple of with individual stocks. That's a portfolio. And you measure their risk against their return. Got this portfolio here. There's its return. There was its standard deviation. And we just keep doing this over and over, collecting data on different portfolios, different sizes, different risk levels of the portfolio, and measure the returns from them. And we do this scatter plot, and we write a paper about it. And over a long, you do a lot of data. Fortunately, since the era of computers, it's a little easier to do. But Lord knows there were people doing it before computers. And something very strange begins to be apparent. No matter how many portfolios you analyze, measure their risk and their standard deviation and their return, they will never be, there will be a boundary, and you'll never find a portfolio on the other side of the boundary. In mathematics, this has been known for centuries. In physics, it's called an envelope. And sure enough, stocks' returns against their risk, their standard deviation of returns, has an envelope. In finance, we call this the frontier of efficient investments. The frontier of efficient investments. There's just nothing on the other side. We see this all through the universe. There's a certain size a star can get to. We'll never find one that's larger than this. In kinesiology, on any given day, there's only so much weight that you can lift. You cannot do more than that. In the human athletics, the envelope for speed was a 4 mile minute. Now, the envelope has gone out a tiny bit down from four, but there is a limit to how fast a human can run. These are all examples of this envelope phenomenon. There's only so much explosive force you can get out of a specific chemical reaction. You cannot ever get more. You have to go to a new technology to get more, from chemical to nuclear, for example, or from nuclear to quantum. But anyway, this is just a very real thing that's out there. Now, a couple of pointers on this. The boundary itself, we don't see. We know what it is. We actually do know what that boundary is. That is world market portfolios. In other words, all of the stocks in the world in different balances. We'll never be able to get that. In other words, the boundary itself, we know what it is, but we cannot actually ever create that portfolio. It would just be practically impossible to do it. It's like in physics, in relativity. We know that the speed of light is a boundary. We know that there's nothing that can get to it for an object that has mass. We can get super close to it with tiny pieces of matter in accelerators, in linear accelerators. But at the same time, we know it's there. We know what it is. And the object, of course, would be, well, when we're forming portfolios, we want to make sure that we're as close to the boundary as possible. That's what the diversification does, is it scoots us up. So in other words, I want this level of return. Okay, well, I want to get, that means that theoretically I can get down to this risk level. But practically speaking, I'm going to be inside and I'll be trying to get as close as I can to the boundary. Now, one thing that if you take a higher level finance course in investments from me, there are ways you can get really close to that theoretical envelope. One way, just to give you a sort of a window on it, you create what's called a super portfolio. You create three or four very well diversified portfolios. Well, portfolio A has 40 stocks in it and they're very low correlated. Portfolio B has 35 other stocks in it. They're very low correlated. In other words, you create a portfolio of portfolios. And if you do that, they'll all be close to the boundary. But the super portfolio that is the composite of those, you got to keep them separate, will actually be really close to the boundary. You're squeezing out as much of that non-systematic risk as you can in the super portfolio trick. It works. It really does. But, you know, at the same time, you're actually watching over a lot of portfolios. However, as I've said before, and I'll mention it again now, you can actually buy a security that is a well-diversified portfolio. As a matter of fact, there are tens of thousands of these. I'll show you very quickly what I'm talking about here. They're called ETFs. Well, that's one version of it, is electronically traded funds, ETFs. And they mentioned these in an earlier chapter in the book, interestingly enough, before they even get to risk and return. But I'll show you. Here's one. Now, this ETF... Now, the way an ETF is essentially, it is just the portfolio of stocks. So you buy this stock of this ETF, you are buying basically that portfolio. Now, here's one for the Standard & Poor's 500. It's one of the SPYDERs, SPY. If you buy a share of this stock, this ETF, you will actually own the S&P 500. That's what it is. The S&P 500 is, the 500, S&P 500 is about 60-70% of the entire world as far as market value goes. Look at this. The beta is 1, which is the beta of the world portfolio. So you could actually own this and you would have a professionally managed world portfolio, virtually, of 500 stocks. Granted, this thing is expensive, but at the same time, you just buy a share whenever you can afford one, and every time you buy a share, you're buying the S&P 500. You are buying the risk of the market. Now, you might say, well, that kind of sucks because I kind of like to have more risk than that or less risk than that. Well, we can fix that too. But these ETFs are quite nice that way. Let me show you another one. Suppose that you don't like stocks. Suppose that you wanted to move into bonds. Here's a bond ETF. As a matter of fact, this ETF is so well regarded that other bond funds are measured with the AGG as the benchmark. And it's a bond fund. Well, spank me, it's beta is one. It's that well diversified. It's the world bond market is basically what this one is. Now, here's an interesting thing that a lot of investors, and you'll learn this in a class if you take my next class, which I'm sure you all want to do or not. A lot of times we'll tell investors, look, you assess what the chances are that the economy is going to be good or bad. And what you do is you put some of your money into an equity fund like SPDR and some of your money into a bond fund like AGG. So when you think the economy is good, you have more of your money in the SPY at the expense of the AGG. If you think the economy is going to hell, then what you would do is you would move more of your money from the SPY into the AGG. So in other words, you are, in a way, it's like not active management, but you just keep an eye on it. The professionals have the internals of it, and all you're doing is just rebalancing your portfolio based upon your best judgment of where the economy is most likely to have its best bets at a given point in time. And you also keep another kind of a little percentage in cash in mutual funds. Like, for example, in a good economy, I'd probably say 70% equity, 25% bonds, and 5% cash. If I think that the economy is going to suck, I'd probably go down to maybe 30% equity, 70% bonds, and 10% cash. And that is a very good way to professionally self-manage your money. You don't play with it every day, but over the cycle, over the economic cycle, the boom-bust cycle, you just make your adjustments at reasonable times and you will come out ahead like you wouldn't believe. Super portfolios and this balancing approach, they can't be beat for making long-term gains. And I'm going to show you how, if you are willing to do this over a period of decades, you will come out a multimillionaire as you approach retirement. I can show you that this happens. This is how it works. Or you can just buy and sell like some crazy person and hope to God for the best. Or you can, like I said, you can do it that way, or you can do it the professional, scientific way. Your call. Finishing this up, sometimes I do a lot of the math and the mumbo jumbo, and sometimes I take you straight to the punchline. But there's something interesting in this frontier of efficient investments. And we knew it all along. Even before the capital asset pricing model, we knew that there was a point that is completely off this frontier. A portfolio of treasuries has no risk, it has no volatility, because they will pay you. So it has zero for standard deviation. And yet, it pays a small positive return, which we call the risk-free rate. That's completely off the frontier. Is there a way that we could leverage this to jump the frontier? The same question has been asked in physics, and the answer is yes. You see, we do know that the speed of light is an absolute limit, but we know that there are ways that we can fold time. And we call them warp drives after the Star Trek, and there's one that is quite viable. It'll take us about 30 years to build one and try it. It's called an Alcubierre warp drive. But we can jump space-time. And just like in portfolios, we can jump the frontier of efficient investment. Essentially, if we can get a portfolio, one of these world portfolios, that's tangent to this line here, all we would have to do to get low risk is to combine T-bills with this world portfolio, and higher risk to borrow money and buy extra of the market portfolio, and we could go anywhere we wanted on that line. It's just like the warp drives. We won't be able to go where we want. We'll be able to travel along the lines of the warp lines. And so, this, we have a name for this. This is called the capital market line. Now, it was actually in the 60s, well, it was in the 50s and the 60s, that this was pretty much appreciated that there was a way to jump the shark. So how do we write that as math that is usable? Well, this is nice, but who's going to be plotting these every day and finding the risk-free rate and all this kind of stuff and drawing these lines and looking at portfolios? We need something that's more useful to us. So what we did was we created a standardized risk measure, non-diversifiable risk. We call it beta. Now, we just by definition say that if it's a beta of 1.00 would be the market risk. The risk of one of these market portfolios. A beta of zero would be the risk-free. And so, basically, we could turn this into something usable. A little linear equation that plotted betas against expected returns. Okay? We would know that a beta of zero would be the risk-free rate, and a beta of 1.00 would be the expected return to the market portfolio. And everything would be along that line. Every portfolio would be on that line. It simplifies it greatly. What does that line look like? I could actually show you. The math is just like high school linear algebra. But you break it down, and what it's, this is the expected return to any stock or portfolio of stocks. This, if I wrote, found the linear equation for this and y equals mx plus b and the m is y2 over y1 minus x2 over x1, I'm not going to show you that. What results from it is this equation, expected return to the stock or portfolio is risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. And it's actually, like I said, I mean, it's kind of tedious, but it's just linear math, linear algebra. I got 2 points on a line, 0, R sub f, and 1, expected return to the market portfolio. If you do that trick with the slope-intercept form of the linear equation, that's what comes out, believe it or not. Sometimes I can't believe it either. We, in fact, even have a name. See this piece right here? The expected return to the market minus risk-free rate, we call that the market premium over risk-free. Essentially, this little piece in here is measuring how much extra reward you get for taking the market risk instead of no risk. It's a premium. And beta is nothing but a magnifier and demagnifier. Now, first of all, real world practice, R sub F, you're going to get a treasury bill's yield. Right now, the risk-free rate is running at about 4.0%. The expected return to the market portfolio is a little bit more complicated. What we're doing these days is these services are taking surveys of industry and academic professionals. I'm in one of those surveys. They ask us all, what do you think the return to the market is going to be over the next year? And we each give our judgment, and then they take the average. And there are a bunch of services that do that. Right now, the services are all arguing around 8.5%. About that right now. Now, interestingly, in the last survey, I'm in a survey of 70 industry and academic professionals. The survey came out with an 8.5. Now, my own, when I gave my number, it was 8.2. So I was a little below what everyone else in the group was thinking. But anyway, so in other words, the market premium right now over risk-free would be 8.50% less 4.00%. So right now the market premium is running at about 4.50%. We got it. That's all you needed for that. So now, suppose that I wanted to know if the beta of a stock I'm considering is 0.75, then this equation, the capital asset pricing model, would say that my expected return should be the risk-free rate, 4.00%, plus 0.75 times the market premium, which is 4.5%. That's what it boils down to. We can actually forecast our expected return to a portfolio. What's the beta of the portfolio? What's the stock of the portfolio? Whatever you want to talk about. Well, in that case, I would have, pulling up a calculator, just a quick, dirty calculator here. I can say 4.0 plus 0.75 times the market premium, 7.375%. Notice two things. One is, remember I said beta is like a magnifier and demagnifier? That's exactly what it's doing here. See how the market's expected return is 8.5%? This beta is saying that the expected return is demagnified. Sure enough, it's a little less, 7.38%. On the other hand, well, what about if I took a stock right now that was like a 1.5 beta? Okay, we can do it. 4%, 4.00, right? Yeah, 4.00 plus, let's say the beta is 1.5 times the market premium of 4.5%. Yeah, 4.5%. 10.75. See, in this case, the beta is above 1, so it's a magnifier. The market's return is expected to be 8.5%. With a beta of 1.50, the stock's return is expected to be a little more, 10.75%. That's all this mumbo jumbo I was just doing for the last 40 minutes or so was all about. We've got a way that we can scientifically forecast not what is going to happen, but what our best understanding of what is going to happen will be. And so, through this, a couple of things come to light. When you hear these people on these talking heads shows, they say, well, we've got a guy here who beat the market. He got a 14% return, which is way above the market. That's nothing. So what? He took a beta that was high and he got an expected return that was high. There's no heroics involved in that at all. You see, because they're assuming, they're sneaking in, the market is this. No, that's not the market. The market is the entire line. And by the way, this line is called the securities market line. It's kind of bad because the cap M is a securities market line, but the other one is the capital market line. Be careful about that on a quiz. I ask that for heaven's sakes, know the distinction. The capital asset pricing model graphs as the securities market line. And that's the market right there. It's not a single point. It's the whole market. So if you tell me you got a great return, aren't you a genius? I'd say, I'm not impressed. You were probably out here someplace taking risk AF. And so, you know, that doesn't matter, mean anything to me. And especially if you're a fund manager, do you think you're a hero because you took all this risk to get this heroic return? What kind of investors were in your fund? If you want to talk about appropriateness of investors, you better tell me that they were willing for you to be way out here at this high beta to get that high return. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.